Health Hour on cliffcentral.com.
Very good morning to you. My name is Jonathan Sinclair and I'm standing in for Dr. Cindy this morning on Health Hour. We're giving our doctor a little bit of a break for the December holidays so she can regroup and come back fresh. Today, a very important show, being the holiday season and being that we're all at home, a lot of us are on leave, a lot of us are traveling, but this is a time when accidents do happen. There is a lot that we need to know, and it may not be the funnest topic that you want to hear about. I don't want you to think of it as a downer. I want you to think of it as just looking out and being aware and just being more conscious in the moment and saving lives. So I'm going to be talking in just a moment to Richard Mulder, who's from Netcare 911. He's going to just be giving us some tips and just some practical things in everyday life that we can do to ensure the safety of our loved ones, of ourselves, of the community. Very excited also in the second half of the show, I'm going to be speaking to somebody who has beaten and survived cancer. As a creative director, Con Bertish has been developing new ways of innovating life and making things simpler. And when he was diagnosed with cancer, he decided to also find solutions and find ways of making his life better. And he managed to beat his cancer. He's going to be joining us on Skype and telling us his full story, also how you can keep up with him. He's doing amazing talks and getting people just to be more inspired in their lives. So we'll keep up with him and see how that's going. But yeah, let's introduce my first guest, Richard Mulder. Thank you so much for coming to the show. I know you guys are very busy this time of year, but interestingly enough, the people in Gauteng actually get a bit of a break this year because everyone is traveling outside of Gauteng.
That's true. Thank you, Jonathan, and hello to the listeners. Definitely, yeah. Gauteng is a bit quiet this time of year. Unfortunately, accidents do happen, like you say. And as much as we'd love to be completely quiet, that isn't always the case. Mm-hmm. The important matter really is A, that prevention is always better than cure.
Yeah.
And we'll be talking a little bit about that. But also that if one knows what to do in those first few critical seconds, it makes our job a lot easier when we get there to really do the big stuff and get them sorted out when it's something serious.
Okay, so Richard, let's just talk about your role at Netcare 911. You're quite a big shot there, I do know that.
Sure, I'm the clinical head for Netcare 911, mm-hmm. so it's my job to make sure that everyone's on the straight and narrow from a professional point of view and mm-hmm. that we know what we're doing, which is thankfully for me quite an easy task with all the professionals and well-qualified individuals that we have working for us.
Okay. All right. So I was speaking to a few paramedics a few weeks ago, actually last week, I think, on the show, or 2 weeks ago. And we were speaking just about how when people are at their worst, you guys are there. And you guys obviously see a lot of people, you see a lot of things, but you don't realize the impact that you have on those people that are there and they're going through the worst time of their lives and you guys are there supporting them. They remember you forever.
Sure. It's a fair responsibility, you know, when you put it that way. In particular, that we, I think, are very humbled as an industry and professionals as a whole to be able to support people in those sort of situations. But we don't like to have to do it. Mm-hmm. I think none of us we all enjoy our jobs, but none of us want to really be there at those times and want to have to be there. We'd rather prefer people to stay safe and keep it good and healthy.
Okay, well, let's just find out what are the major calls. It is December, it is holiday time. So at this time of the year, what are the biggest calls that you guys have coming through?
Sure. So one of the first and major ones we see a lot of this time of year in particular, we all know everyone's on holiday, everyone's relaxing by the pool or at the ocean, the seaside, depending where you are. And drownings are a very real part of that, unfortunately. Again, it's all about staying vigilant, seeing what's going on and avoiding these kind of things, especially when children and younger people are involved. But if someone has ended up, unfortunately, in a pool or in the ocean and has then drowned, the first thing to remember for you as a bystander or person there is to be safe yourself. There's no point in running into the ocean and becoming a patient yourself and adding to the challenging situation. But if it's safe to get the person out of the water, that's obviously the first port of call. Drownings are quite a serious matter, so early activation or early contacting of emergency service is crucial so that we can get going while you're doing what you can. And then turning the patient on their side, if they're not breathing, initiating CPR, which we'll have a quick chat about towards the end of this. But really, those are the main things there. Vigilance is the big one there. Once the drowning's happened, there's not too much that the bystander can do. That's where the professionals have to take over and make sure that what can be done is done.
Okay, so it's one thing to be in the ocean and to have a sort of accident, a drowning accident. But let's talk about people in their homes. I would imagine if you look away from your toddler, your four-year-old, your five-year-old for 5 minutes, you run to the loo quick, maybe make some tea, you think your kid playing outside is safe because perhaps if they were to fall in, maybe you think they would know what to do. Also, perhaps you think you would hear a splash. Is that not necessarily the case?
No. Look, the reality is 10 seconds is too long. I mean, even looking away for a second is just too much with kids and that kind of thing. There is no substitute for having a covered pool or a fence around the pool and avoiding that kind of thing. Or if the child or pool is uncovered and the child is outside, is to just be vigilant and watch them every step that they're taking. You know, there's an old adage of one can technically drown in a teaspoon of water, which is very true. There doesn't need to be a splash. They don't need to fall in the deep end. It could be in ankle-deep water, unfortunately, that it could happen. So really, the only way around that is either to have the pool covered or secured and obviously keep a close eye on the child. Or toddler.
I would imagine a lot of people think my kid knows how to swim, therefore they don't need supervision. I don't imagine that's the case. What is a good age perhaps to maybe allow your children to be alone around the pool all day?
Look, even if the child can swim and it was a strong swimmer, if they slip and fall and knock their head, that all goes out the window, unfortunately. So there is really no benchmark sort of age where you can say it's now safe to leave your child unattended. It really is a case of being hypervigilant around the pool.
I would imagine in a family that has some teenagers, possibly, it would be good to have a rule in your home. Maybe no one's allowed in the pool without a buddy. Have a buddy system.
Certainly.
Because anything can go wrong, even if you, like you say, you are the best swimmer. Let's get the other horrible one out of the way, Richard. Road accidents this time of year. Joburg's roads are quieter. We were talking about how beautiful traffic is at the moment. It doesn't take away the risk. People traveling, what advice do you have?
Look, again, there's no rush to get anywhere. You know, the holiday season is long and there's lots of time ahead. The 5 or 10 minutes you'll save by rushing from one point to the next just isn't worth it. So speed is obviously, as we know, one of the major issues on our roads. Taking it slow, planning ahead, those are the big things. The other one, unfortunately, is with the festive season and all the parties and festivities carrying on, is alcohol. There really just is no margin for error with alcohol and driving. It just shouldn't be done. We unfortunately see a huge number of road accidents due to alcohol and excessive speed. And the simple one is don't do it. That is the simple solution to that particular problem. Once someone who's intoxicated has gotten behind the wheel, you know, the outcome is unfortunately more often than not going to be a positive one. So that really is the very simple answer to that question.
Okay, now, just before the show, Richard, you and I were having a chat, and something which I never really thought about is, you mentioned, what was it, the big four? And these are things like when you go to a braai, you don't think of these little dangers, like the danger literally starts when you get there. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So we spoke about the braai and the festivities, or the cooking in the kitchen even, both of them. And the fact that when you have heat or flames involved, burns are a very real possibility. Whether they be burns from the braai itself or just being in the sun too long and being, you know, burnt by a wonderful African sun. You know, the reality of when fires are being lit or the meat is being turned, of people burning hands and faces and things is very, very common. You know, and I think some small tips around that, apart from, again, the vigilance that I keep saying, is if a burn has occurred, is to get that burn cooled as quickly as possible. Not plunging into an ice-cold bucket of beer, but to have cool running water over that site, preferably clean water if one can, and to remove any tight objects like wedding bands or watches or tight belts and things if it's that area. Because when that appendage starts swelling due to the burn, that constriction can actually become more of a problem than the burn itself.
Those are things you never think about.
The little things, yes.
Okay, so this is, I would imagine, from the start. Let's pretend we're having a family braai, we've got people coming over. So literally, right from the beginning, there's danger. You need to look out. What are the other three that we
so we covered the first, all the drownings, and the alcohol and the driving.
Driving, all right.
The last one really in that set of four, if you will, which is possibly counterintuitive to some people, this festive time of the year is unfortunately a rather high rate of depression and suicide. We do see an elevated number of suicides or attempted suicides, calls for help, that kind of thing this time of year. And with that, really, there are various helplines available. family support structures and being very aware of how your loved one is feeling and just spending that extra bit of time, not to assume that someone has a support structure. You know, just be there for one another. That's
so
the big
this
stuff.
One is a bit more tough. It's not as simple as sort of watching your kid at the pool or ensuring that you don't drink and drive. This is something that's going on in private, perhaps. Maybe some warning signs. Do you know any of that type of thing? I mean, you guys obviously deal with the thing once it's happened. But I mean, like you say, prevention.
Yeah, the reality with those kind of, not disorders, but challenges are that they are so varied. It is very difficult to give key signs. Someone that's very withdrawn, appears sad, not wanting to participate in anything are quite easy ones or obvious ones, but they aren't always, the signs aren't always quite that obvious, unfortunately. Throw into the mix a few drinks or in the festivities, and that unfortunately exacerbates the situation and can compound an unhappy person even further.
Is there anything you can do in terms of not leaving things lying around? I know this is a terrible subject, but for instance, you maybe don't leave pills lying around, don't leave certain types of rope or razors lying around. I mean, it's a horrible way to think, but is this a necessity?
Look, if there's a history of that kind of behavior, those things should be considered. I think it's quite difficult to say, you know, he isn't feeling too great, let's hide all the pills.
Yeah.
But if there's a history of attempted suicide or depression or that kind of thing, one certainly shouldn't leave, especially medication. It's a very easy option. You shouldn't leave those lying around, keep them locked away, keep them safe. As for the rest of it, you know, if someone really wants to go that route, they will find a way. Unfortunately, it's just one of those things. But you do need to be hypervigilant again about what are those warning signs.
Okay, Richard, it's one thing to talk about preventing all of these things.
Sure.
What about once it's happened? Now it's happened, I've realized it. What do I do first?
Right, so if it is a major incident, the first thing to do is call the emergency services. You know, NetCare 911 is one of those that you can contact. And we have a value that we've espoused for quite some time, which we refer to as time saves lives. Okay. You know, time is critical and is crucial. Often people will say, you know, look, we'll see how it goes, we'll wait it out. If they're not feeling too great, we'll sort things out later. By that time, it's often too late. So really, time is very, very critical. Also, when contacting emergency services, it is important to remember the key information. And you might get very frustrated in the heat of the moment, where they ask you for your address, your phone number, your name. You know, you might wonder why they're delaying. I'm trying to tell them what's wrong with the patient. The reality there is, if the line gets cut off, that's the only means to get back to you.
So they'd rather get that information out of you first before finding out all the nitty-gritty about the patients.
Correct. I mean, if you think about it, if you've called in and you get cut off halfway through a story, we have no contact number to get back to you. That whole thing becomes quite challenging. So even if we can't get back to you after the fact, if we have your address, someone will be sent to assist you.
So also, I think in that emergency, it's good to, if there are a group of people, to let the most calm person phone, the one who's going to get the information across. Sure. Don't just let the most hysterical person phone the ambulance. Okay.
And preferably also the person that knows where they are. I mean, with all the traveling and visiting friends this time of year, you might not be at home. You might not know the landmarks or the address. It's important to get that kind of information across correctly so that the emergency services can make it to you in a timeous fashion.
Okay, Richard, let's just stay on this point a bit. Let's say I am in Durban, for instance, and I dial 082911. Now, does that go to a national sort of hotline? And then, or do they kind of know what area I'm in?
So we do have a national call center. It's based here in Gauteng. With the advances in smartphones and all the rest of it, geolocation is a very real possibility and something we do pursue quite actively. But if small little things like your GPS or whatever on your phone isn't enabled, we won't be able to see where you're calling from. So it is important to say, I'm in Durban and this is where I am. So just to give that context as well. The beauty, once we know where it is, it's plotted on a map with which all the vehicles that we have in our fleet and additional resources we have available to us are linked to, and you will be sent the closest one to your actual location, which is really the way we try and do things to expedite the process.
Okay, interesting. Also, something that I only found out a few years ago is when you're driving along the highway, you see all those little blue wooden boards that have those weird numbers on it. I didn't realize those are sort of geographical markers for paramedics and police. So if ever you in an emergency, the nearest board to you, you give them that number.
Correct.
And
so those are route markers, those are identifiers. We are moving very rapidly with advances in technology to a point where those might become obsolete, because with, as I've said, with your phone, with the smartphones these days, you know, that does assist greatly in the process as well. But it's still important to keep an eye out for those kind of signs and things.
Okay, so we were getting off topic. We were talking about what we do in the emergency.
Sure. So the first thing, again, is preparation, is being prepared for these things. And we don't, as you said, we don't want to think negatively about it, but something as simple as having a box of plasters, some bandages, some antiseptic cream, that kind of thing in the home, mm-hmm. you know, is a starting point. Is a starting point to control some of the things like the bleedings, infection, and the rest of it. With the minor cuts and bruises and that sort of thing, you know, hemorrhage control or controlling the bleeding is your priority, if it's a major bleed in particular. And that's achieved by placing pressure directly on the site of the bleeding, of the wound, or just above. When I say just above, is obviously to occlude any kind of artery or vein that's causing the bleeding, mm-hmm. And also to a degree will supplement the pressure on the wound itself and allow it to clot and close up. So from a cuts and bruises point of view, that's really the big thing. The other big one which I wanted to chat about, Jonathan, was the CPR.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, CPR has been around for many, many years now. It's gone through a number of changes, and a lot of people in the past have said, well, you know, I don't know the person, or I don't want to get that close to the person and breathe into their mouth. And, you know, with all the diseases we have these days, it's a risk. So over the last decade, you know, the big organizations that review CPR itself around the world have moved towards something called hands-only CPR, which is obviously taking out the whole mouth-to-mouth aspect completely.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, if you've seen an adult or an adolescent, for that matter, collapse, it really is a case of putting both hands in the middle of the chest and pushing at a rate of 100 beats per minute, and that's it. That is CPR in this day and age for the bystander, for the non-medical professional. That's all you need to do. And that can prolong the time that the person is viable for the emergency service to get there, and can actually, and has been shown to improve survivability, or double the chances of survivability in witnessed collapse.
Okay, so now I'm confused in terms of CPR. Is it really about getting air into the lungs, or is it more about keeping the person's heart beating?
Right. So it's really not about the air at all anymore. That's from years gone by. That's been learned through the studies and tests and things. That isn't the priority. The priority is really to massage the heart, if you will, to keep the blood flowing through the body and perfusing the vital organs, like the brain, that can't sustain mm-hmm. without blood flow or oxygenation for any period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Purely by the changes in pressure inside the chest from the compressions, there's enough air movement to support the oxygenation process. So the breathing into the person's mouth is really no longer a major thing for the bystander.
So this actually sounds quite simple then. So for every minute, you put your hands in the middle of the chest and you push down 100 times.
Correct.
For every 60
correct.
Seconds.
Now, there's a couple of easy ways to get that rate correct. Slightly corny, the one of them, but the Bee Gees song "Staying Alive."
How does it go?
I won't sing it for you. That beat is 100 beats per minute. So the beat of the song is 100 beats per minute.
Okay.
Right now, for the Star Wars fans out there, the Imperial March, Darth Vader's entrance theme,
mm-hmm.
104 beats per minute. So if you can hum that.
That's incredible.
That's the right rate.
I'm sure
to be
anybody
compressing.
Can do that.
Really, anyone can do that. There have actually been multiple stories of children managing to do it
because of that.
Just because it's so simple.
But can you imagine now this person has collapsed, you on top of them pressing down, singing the Darth Vader entrance song?
Well, so you can hum it to yourself. It might be more appropriate. But in terms of just understanding how easy it really is, that's as simple as it is for CPR, and it's a major, major thing.
It really is simple, and like you say, it's just about keeping them alive until the paramedics get there. Don't try to be Superman. You know, we've all seen things on TV where they cut open the throat to get airflow back, but I suppose on that subject, choking is also a hazard. What advice do you have should someone choke?
So choking is the other big one, having the Borvos around the braai again, going back to the braai. The Heimlich maneuver, which I suppose we all are familiar with, is also not really the in thing anymore. Providing strong slaps to the back between the shoulder blade is actually the preferred manner of dislodging a piece of meat or foreign body that's obstructed the airway.
Okay.
Choking is one of the easier ones to identify. You know, the person will be turning blue or purple, generally have their hands around or near their throat, indicating that they're choking.
Mm-hmm. That's sort of the universal sign, huh?
Pretty much. Yeah. That's the one there. Look, if the other part though is if you are by yourself and you have no one around you, you know, and you're choking, or what do you do then? You have a few seconds before you pass out from lack of oxygenation. Find a chair, get your abdomen over the chair, and actually just forcefully drop yourself onto the rear of the chair rest to get that force and try and dislodge the clot. Try and cough try and get that object out. So those are options.
Okay, you would say avoid Heimlich maneuver if you can. You say pats on the back. Whereabouts? Middle of the back?
Right between the shoulder blades.
Okay, you kind of bend the person over, I would imagine, or
just
whatever.
It doesn't really matter. It's quite a solid wallop to between the shoulder blades. The Heimlich maneuver is still out there. People are still doing it and trying it. It just has been shown not to be as effective as the slaps to the back.
Okay. I also, just talking about the Heimlich maneuver, it is dangerous for children under a certain age. You can damage ribs and puncture lungs.
Correct.
And all sorts of things.
Correct.
Like that.
There are some risks involved. Those risks are generally outweighed by the benefit of dislodging the choking or the object obstructing the airway.
Mm-hmm.
So with CPR as well, just to jump back to that quickly, if ribs do crack while you're pushing on the chest, that's all right. That's quite a normal thing. In the efforts to adequately compress the heart and really keep that key function going, that's the sort of collateral damage, if you will, in the process.
Okay. All right. Something else I don't think we take seriously enough is bee stings this time of year. You know, everyone, like you say, is by the pool and stuff. And I think a lot of people who haven't been stung don't actually know if they're allergic or not. So
sure.
Do you see instances of that rising this time of year?
Look, the instances of stings from bees, spider bites, all the rest of that kind of thing, stay fairly constant throughout the year. There is an elevation over the spring and summer months when people start spending more time outside and all the rest of it, but not specifically over the Christmas period as such. With the bee sting, it's a difficult one, as you say, because most people don't know whether they are or aren't allergic.
Mm-hmm.
A good indication is to keep an eye at the actual site of the sting. If it starts becoming red and swollen very rapidly,
okay,
or one gets a scratchiness in the throat, That's a pretty important sign not to overlook.
So should we all, just in our normal medicine cabinet, be keeping some sort of antihistamine or something like that?
The antihistamine will help for the localized site of the sting. If you are truly allergic, it's not going to do a whole bunch. It will help. It might slow the process and, again, allow the emergency services more time to get to you. But that won't actually prevent a true allergic reaction from taking place.
I also would imagine trying to get a pull down the throat of someone who's having an allergic reaction is quite difficult. So
it's near impossible. Sure.
Child.
Yeah.
All right, Richard, you know the time's gone so fast. We're already like halfway through. So I just want to say thanks so much for joining us. I really wish you well over the season. We can keep up with you guys. It's at netcare_911_SA.
Correct, yes.
Okay, cool. And then, of course, that emergency number, wherever you are in South Africa, is 082-911. And that's from any cell phone network, eh?
Correct, yes.
All right, Richard, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Really, I'm sure we've helped some people. And yeah, in your time of need and your time of emergency, I think the best thing is just to be calm, if that is possible.
No, that's it. That's it. Thank you very much to you, Jonathan, and your listeners. Have a great festive season. Thank you.
Health Hour on cliffcentral.com.
At Sibanye Gold, we believe leaders are made, not born. We also believe we can create a sustainable legacy by helping to develop tomorrow's leaders today. Which is why we have partnered with the Leadership Platform to nurture leaders who are committed to growing our country's economy.
We are proud to say it's an initiative that's already showing glittering results. Sibanye Gold, we are one.
Health Hour on cliffcentral.com.
Yes, Jonathan Sinclair standing in for Dr. Cindy this Monday morning. Now, we just spoken to Richard Mulder from Netcare 911 about some holiday safety tips, what to do in an emergency. And knowledge really is just power. Just in those situations, you can save a person's life, and rather just be safe than sorry. But now, talking to a new guest of mine, he's joining me via Skype. Con Bertish is a cancer survivor. He's now a motivational speaker and author, and he's really been doing amazing things. Con, let's see the Skype line. How's it, Con?
Hey, hi, Jonathan. It's Con from Cape Town.
Hey, man. How's it going? Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Con, won't you just tell us a little bit about your story? Obviously, it's hard to sum up your entire life in a few minutes, but won't you just tell us the gist of it and how you came to be where you are now in your life?
Okay, cool. I mean, yeah. So basically, my story is one that is affected by cancer, mm-hmm. which was a biggie, brain cancer. And it was about 9 years ago when I noticed I've been in advertising for the last 20 years. And about 9 years ago, I started realizing that I was slurring my words slightly.
Okay.
And I realized that I was my balance was a little bit off. Mm-hmm. I was tripping on things, and I was started getting these really vicious headaches. Mm-hmm. And I went to a myriad of different doctors trying to determine what these headaches were, and they were, you know, they considered, you're in advertising. This is a very stressful industry. That's stress. It must be stress. Stress headaches. Mm-hmm. And obviously, at the time, I was spending a lot of my days and nights working in advertising with a big goal of transforming the agency which I had taken over into a top creative agency. And so I was putting a lot of energy into that and probably disregarding a lot of issues and the health issues that I should have been more aware of. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Lack of sleep, a whole lot of those things. And anyway, so these doctors were giving me vitamin B injections in my left or right buttock on a regular mm-hmm. basis, but they weren't working.
Okay.
And after about a month or more, it was I actually was at home and somebody phoned my house and I wrote and they wanted to speak to my wife Heidi, and I wrote down the person's number on a piece of paper to call them back, and I wrote down 083455 and I wrote the number down, and then I put the phone down. I looked down at the page and I saw that my writing was really bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
scary.
And then I also noticed that I had written 093 instead of 083.
Mm-hmm.
So I corrected the 9 into an 8.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when my pen came off the page, I realized I'd written 9 again.
Oh, no. So almost you knew what you wanted to do inside of your head, but you couldn't get that message through to your hand.
Exactly. So I wanted to write an 8. So I took another piece of paper and I wrote an 8. And when I looked at the page, it was a 9.
Mm-hmm. These are really scary things that are happening to you. You almost feel powerless. You don't know what's going on. I can just imagine what you were going through at that period.
Well, that's it. I think that is – so that powerlessness is a very important part of the work that I'm doing now is at that moment, yes, completely out of control, because your mind is telling – your body to write something
mm-hmm,
and it
mm-hmm.
isn't responding properly. And that is the power of the brain and how complicated and intricate our brains are and how they, mm-hmm. they help us perform, you know, even the most simple tasks. So that experience sent me to a neurologist
mm-hmm.
to work out what was going on in my brain, because this was serious stuff. And that ended up with an MRI scan mm-hmm. that showed a tumor the size of a squash ball in the back of my brain.
Sure.
And then it was, then was emergency surgery straight away. Sure. And basically, what was happening is this tumor was causing a disconnect between my left and right hemispheres.
Mm-hmm.
So I could do the top half of the 8, but I couldn't cross my midline to come back. I just went straight up to form a 9. Very interesting stuff. And that actually began my interest in neuroscience and neuropsychology and the science called psychoneuroimmunology, which is how your mind affects how your body behaves, but more so how your brain is really your key element. Without that thing, you can't operate at all.
Okay, so, sorry just to stop you there. How old were you at this point in your life? I mean, you're obviously an adult. You've got a career on the go. So how old were you?
34 years old.
34 years old.
Two
eh?
Kids. Two kids. I had a 1.5-year-old son and a 3.5-year-old daughter at the time.
Sure. So you go for this MRI scan. They find this thing the size of a squash ball in the back of your brain. Operate immediately. What was that process like? I mean, I can imagine quite a painful operation, lots of recovery time. And then also I would imagine then they want to treat you with chemotherapy or radiation.
Well, that's it. That's the kind of the normal story is that you go in and this is the part, this is the crux of the issue that caused me to do what I'm doing, which was I was faced with signing this form before the double, because I went for two brain surgeries, microbrain surgeries, one to relieve the pressure and then the other one 24 hours later to try and get as much of the tumor out as possible. And I had to sign these forms for these brain surgeries I was undergoing, and the forms were insane. I've actually dubbed them the world's most terrifying forms, because they literally say, look, we're going to try and get the tumor out as much of it as we can, but you must realize that we're working in the brain.
Yeah.
So even though you might wake up, well, you might not, but you also, even though you might wake up, you may not feel like yourself again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine they ask you
senses. Yeah.
Yeah. They would ask you, like, for instance, should you wake up and you're like this, or you're on a ventilator, what do you want to happen? Do they ask you those questions?
Well, they do, but they also have other things. You basically got to sign this form that says, look, that I might survive the surgery, but I might be blind, and I might have lost my senses, my sense of balance, or my speech, or my hearing. Those are the things that I, because they're digging around in your brain, and they're working in the working part of the brain. They are doing surgery in the working part of your brain. So I decided at that moment, and this is the crux of what I'm doing. At that moment, I decided, okay, I'm going to play a role. I'm not going to be just a traditional patient. Mm-hmm. I believe in the mind-body connection. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to prepare my brain for the surgery that's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagined my brain was this bouncy brain. I called it the bouncy brain. Mm-hmm. No matter what they took out of my brain, it would just bounce back into shape. So I kind of prepared it. I had this weird visualization that I was working on, like, bang, bang, and even had a sound to it, the bouncy brain. Bang, 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 bang. It was kind of crazy, but it gave me something to do, because I believe that your mind affects how your body behaves. I mean, that's just science. That's just straight neuroscience. Is if you can think about something in your body, you can affect it in some way. And that's the science of psychoneuroimmunology, how your mind affects how your body behaves. And I started playing with this thing and making my brain pliable.
Mm-hmm.
And my surgeries went very well, and it was great. But for me, it fed me. It gave me a role in my own healing. And that's something that I continued for the years of treatment that I underwent. And it was all of those. So as the tumor came out, most of the tumor came out, I had to go for then follow up on what type of cancer it was, and wait for 5 days when it was sent to the lab, and then it came back, and it was a rare form of adult cancer called medulloblastoma, which is kind of more prevalent for children under the age of 5. Mm-hmm. So everyone was scratching their heads as to why a 34-year-old guy had this type of cancer. It made sense to a lot of my family and friends, because I've always been told I was very childish. Should grow up, take these more seriously. But in a way, that playfulness helped, because I started to augment my treatments using this thinking, this playful thinking, which I started doing with my bouncy brain. Mm-hmm. I started seeing myself. I engaged with the chemotherapy and the radiation and the other things I underwent, and I turned them. I almost gamified them. So I really was involved. I was imagining the chemotherapy as this fizzing kind of roller coaster ride of fizzing action that was fizzing these cells out of my body, and I would expel them at a later point. And I really began using the world as almost my metaphorical playground,
mm-hmm.
where I was walking and imagining I was leaving cancer cells behind me. And so what I had done, and as the months wore on, I started kind of looking at other people, because I'm very interested in humans. And I started doing these portraits. I did about 150 portraits of other people that I met along the way in hospitals, etc. And I realized that the majority of them were they were lost. They had no role. They had never been given a role in their own healing.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was doing by creating a role for myself, I wasn't helpless. When humans are helpless, their immune systems are compromised. Mm-hmm. That's what happens in the fight and flight. Like, oh, I don't have a role in anything. Humans often fall into depression.
Okay.
What I had done is I had given myself a role in my own healing. So I wasn't helpless. I had a job to do.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I could have an effect. And this is where science, technology, and medicine are now merging together, and they're showing how things like psychoneuroimmunology, how what you're doing in your mind, the psychology of yourself, how that affects your immune system. Mm-hmm. So as I went through this process and the years that followed, I started realizing that, like, not only had these other people facing cancer, they'd never been given a role in their own healing. Mm-hmm. They also, many of them couldn't see the role in their own healing because the majority of people are not visual thinkers. And I'd been a visual thinker for the last 15 years. So it came naturally to me. And most people can be visual thinkers, but they've never been taught or it's not part of their lives. You know, visuals are provided to them on their multiple screens.
Okay.
So I thought, well, if I could show them, or if I could create tools that could help, you know, your regular patient see what's going on inside their bodies and begin to imagine and play a role in their own healing, augmenting their different treatments and boosting their own immune systems, then we would have a different, it's almost changing the lexicon of cancer, which is you're diagnosed with this thing and that's you out of the picture. And that this is what science, and this is where I'm getting a lot of amazing support from the medical fraternity. And I have literally opened the Society of International Pediatric Oncology, the conference at the CTICC in Cape Town in November. And I literally opened it to about 1,400 pediatric oncologists and cancer practitioners. And I literally opened this talk, and I was a bit worried about it because these guys are staunch, you know, they deal with life and death. They don't take things lightly, new treatments lightly. But I talked about this approach of, which is this new entity that I'm building called Cancer Dojo, mm-hmm. which is a place where people can connect to what's going on inside them and boost their own immune systems and change the way that people view cancer. Because at the moment, it's such a scary thing. It's such a scary thing that people disconnect from their cancers because it's so scary. And that approach is, it's just, it's not good for your healing system, because when you're in that fearful, helpless space, your immune system is compromised. As soon as you take a role and play a role in it, suddenly you're not helpless. Your immune system is stronger. So there are amazing techniques and strategies to help people be, to boost their immune systems or to be more positive.
Okay, so Khan, you're giving people these images, is that correct? I'm just actually on your Cancer Dojo website, and for instance, I'm seeing a little cartoon. It says, imagine your cancer is a hot air balloon, you are a giant safety pin, and then you see the giant safety pin like pointing at the hot air balloon. So it's these little images that can really make more playful images in the mind of what is going on inside a person dealing with cancer.
Yeah, Jonathan, that's one element of them. So that for me, that's almost the start of getting people to start engaging in their own cancer, not disconnecting. So everybody can imagine. And if I can spark imagination in people, and this is a project that I'm working with a range of different big global partners to change the way that basically change the lexicon of cancer around the world. Mm-hmm. So I am working with, at the moment, 19 different JWT offices, which was an old agency that I used to work for on their Global Creative Council. And I'm basically going to be working with Google as well. And it looks like Facebook too, in terms of how we can, because one of the issues that I've got is that when people are diagnosed with a specific cancer, whether it's a liver cancer or whatever, they walk out of the oncology room and they Google liver cancer. Oof, and then goodness, the stuff that comes up is absolutely shocking.
I can just imagine.
That it causes people to disconnect. So what I'm doing is I'm using all of this content, this Imagine Your Cancer, and I'm going to affect Google search results together with Google and a range of different big global partners. And this is the beginning of changing the way the world deals with cancer. And then it starts going into a whole lot of other approaches. So the other one is a mobile app that I'm working on, as well as a whole lot of different kind of stimulus in terms, some of it's just like collateral all sorts of different things, books that I'm going to be bringing out and workbooks for people to actually start engaging, helping them to engage. Everyone can think visually. At the moment, this is a problem because, you know, a lot of people don't think that they are creative in any way. And it takes that kind of mindset to imagine something. And this is where I do a lot of talks for creative agencies. And I've done one recently. I opened the Italian Design Festival in Milan to over 1,800 designers, Italian designers.
No pressure.
And talked about, and I opened the conference with like, you guys don't realize how lucky you are. Because you're able to, you have the skills now and the talents because you've worked on them, you're able to take something that's invisible and make it visible. The majority of people in the world don't have that talent yet. They can, but they don't, they've never practiced it. So when you can take something that's invisible, which is cancer, it's inside you, you don't know how to deal with it, but if you can make it visible and so that you can engage with it in your own unique way, suddenly it changes the game. And this is where a lot of doctors, Red Cross Children's Hospital, I've got professors of science and medicine, and Dr. Tim Noakes, Prof. Noakes. I've just got so many of these doctors are coming to me saying, this is exactly what we need. This is the future of medicine, where humans are playing a role in their own healing together with the medicine. It's not a this or that. You can augment your treatments using your thinking. And I think society is moving to a space where we are understanding things like meditation, qigong, yoga, these things which have an effect on your mindfulness and how you can play a role in yourself. And it's really an understanding of yourself within a space. And as soon as you can do that, you essentially, and this is what all the doctors are agreeing upon, is that you stand a better chance of more positive recovery, outcome, more positive outcome. So, you know, some people believe it can add a lot more, and some people believe it can add less, but all believe that it can only do good. So surely, and this is my thinking too, is a lot of top sports people use this kind of stuff. And I use the example of Tiger Woods in a lot of the talks that I do. Is Tiger Woods, before he did the whole, his whole lady issue, you know, he was arguably and still is arguably one of the world's, you know, greatest sports people. He was able to achieve these things. And what he used with his sports psychologist, he used a similar approach where he was able to connect his mind to his body in a way that enabled it to perform at its absolute peak. And my thinking is, well, and a lot of sports people do this. So I thought, this is, you know, surely if you're facing cancer or death, surely you want your mind and your body to perform at absolute peak so that you have stand the best chance of overcoming that obstacle, achieving that goal. And that's what I'm working with all of these different entities that are now coming together to build this thing and to change the global lexicon around cancer, because at the moment it's fear-based. People even use the word cancer as an adjective for other things that are negative. But it doesn't have to be. And I often do another talk, which is the one I did to all the pediatric oncologists. I said, you know, this is the best time in human history to be diagnosed with cancer. And it is. Technology, sociology and science and medicine and creativity are merging to create solutions that have never been even imagined before. So it's really about changing that mindset, because as soon as you change your mindset, you stand a better chance at a more positive outcome.
It really is fascinating to me how much our mind and our thoughts does play a role in everything that goes on within our lives. And I think you are just proof of that. But now, where did this inner thing, this inner strength within you come from? I mean, have you always been this way? Have you always been able to overcome issues and just look at the positive side and find solutions? I mean, when you're diagnosed with cancer, you're at the lowest point in your life, but somehow you said, no, this is not me. This is not where I want to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting question, because what I've been doing as a creative director for so many years is I'm impassioned about solving problems using creativity. And it really is part of who I am, and a lot of that creativity I've run headed up a lot of studios in my career. And one of the things that I do is I try and engender a space of non-threatening playfulness and fun. And that's the best way to solve problems, because as soon as you put a whole bunch of people together and ask them to come up with ideas, a lot of people get very scared to put their ideas out because they're not sure what people will think. So what I do is I create a space which is totally non-threatening and playful, and you can throw out any idea, because any idea can be amazing. Even the worst ideas, put them out, because somebody else will take that thinking and bounce it somewhere else, and that leads you to somewhere else. So very much the same approach to solving problems, which I have been doing for many years, I kind of translated into my own way of dealing with cancer. I started playing with my cancer and coming up with these crazy fun stories and these visuals and almost animated films in my head, which brought my cancer to life in a way that I could deal with it and play with it and come up with other ideas. And I started engaging with it. And that was my kind of solve. And the more I did them, the more it helped. And luckily I had a very forward-thinking oncologist who really supported me and was quite amazed with what I was doing. And actually he was the one who kind of said to me, well, geez, you really should start sharing these. And I had been thinking about it, and it got to a point where I realized as more medical people heard about it, I realized I needed to really pull this thing off. And I had been carrying it around for 3 or 4 years in my backpack. I even call it my second tumor, because I didn't know what to do. It was so large in terms of how to bring it to life. And I wasn't getting to it because I was obviously in another role as executive creative director of another agency, and I just couldn't do it. And I realized the only way that I had to do it was to resign from my work and focus completely on pulling this idea off.
Yeah.
So that's what I did on April Fool's this year, which was kind of fitting. I resigned from my role at an agency called Quirk, to literally bring this ideology to life. And it's growing, and it's getting the right partners around the world involved. But I'm still working hard, you know, to make this thing happen. But it'll get there. And yeah, it has the right support.
Con, we're almost out of time, but I kind of see your mission. I love where you're going with it. I love that you're working with Google to influence search results when people, for instance, search liver cancer just after they've been diagnosed. I love how you initiate and you say that cancer is used as an adjective for other things. So if someone is a bad seed in the office, they're referred to as a cancer, or, you know, we use that word to describe bad things. And I love your purpose of changing that. And I think you really are going to be affecting lives. Just in closing, won't you just tell us how we can keep up with you, how can we can get involved with Cancer Jojo? Also about your talk, Happy People Are Hard to Kill. Won't you tell us about that?
Cool. So happy people are harder to kill is a phrase that I came up with after all of this research that I've been doing about how happy people have stronger immune systems, and they therefore are harder to kill. They don't get sick as much. They're able to be more resilient and bounce back. So these are different ways that you can boost your own immune system. And at the same time, start getting people to think creatively, visually, because those things feed you. They enable you to engage. You can follow what I'm doing on Twitter at Convertish and at Cancer Dojo, cancerdojo.org. So it's www.cancerdojo.org. And I do a range of different talks. They last from between half an hour to an hour. And I'm up in Joburg a couple of times in 2016. January and February.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's what I'm up to. And I'm working on some workbooks and some books around how to literally, these are tools to help people engage in ways that are unique to who they are with their disease. And again, this isn't all about cancer. This is about us humans trying to make our way through, you know, across and through these challenges that are thrown at us in our daily lives. But my story is cancer-based, yeah.
Con, really, you truly are an inspiration. I wish you luck with everything. I know you're going to do amazing things and you're going to really impact people. And I really do hope that one day we'll have you in studio here on the Health Hour and you can join Dr. Cindy or myself. And just really, I think it'll be fantastic to meet you. And I wish you all the luck.
Super, Jonathan. Thanks for the opportunity to chat.
Cool, Con. Have a good day. Cheers. Bye-bye. All right, so that's been it for this edition of the Health Hour. Jonathan Sinclair standing in for Dr. Cindy. She will be back soon, but until then, stay tuned to Cliff Central.
Health Hour on cliffcentral.com.